The following presentation was recorded at the 1999 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
First of all, I have a confession to make. The reason why this change was made was because I had the impression this workshop was going to be an hour. And when I got here and picked up the program, I didn't quite know what to do. I scrambled and I... All right, we're going to talk about English. And this is my favorite subject, besides spiritual discussions of various sorts. As a small boy, I remember I was fascinated with the English language, and I've never lost that fascination. And after I left the classroom, I tried to figure out what marketable skill I had, and I didn't have any. Really, I wasn't a carpenter, I wasn't a mechanic, and I wasn't a lot of other things that other people can go out to the job market with. And so I decided to market what little skill I had with the English language. So I am a copy editor, commercial copy editor, for medical journals, for the regular publishers. And it's a job I love. Most people see the work that I do and they say they wouldn't like that. But I love words. So let's talk a little bit about the English language. How many of you believe that you have such a feel for words that you could write poetry? Well, you wouldn't put up your hand even if you thought that, probably. I remember a story told by Paul Erb, who was the editor of the Gospel Herald. There was this dear old brother somewhere in the Mennonite church that kept sending him poetry, in quotes. And he didn't publish any of it. He just piled it on a corner of his desk. And one day he decided the pile was large enough that maybe he better do something with it. So he got himself a nice big manila envelope. And stuffed all this poetry into it and decided he better write a cover letter. So he very tactfully wrote in a cover letter, "Maybe you would like to try your hand at writing prose." And about a week later, he got a letter back from the dear brother, a very tart letter. And it said, "Let them as can't write poetry write prose." So those of us who can't write poetry will write prose. But there's a way to write prose, and there's a way not to write prose. So let's, first of all, I want you to take a look at this. Just read down through it. Tell me what you think of it. Sounds like the kind of ordinary prose that you would read in a publication, Christian publication. And it actually has some things to commend itself, to commend it. It's not written in a passive tense like much writing is. I didn't even look to see if there any is or was. There's some V's in there. But we must be careful not to fool ourselves. That's a good sentence. God will not be swayed, that's a good word, by our clever rationalizations. That's a little bit big there, but that's a good sentence. If we indulge our sensual desires, we can expect the consequences to be bad. That's straightforward. However, if we obey the Spirit of God, the result will be true life. Therefore, we should not get tired of doing good deeds. We shall be rewarded if we are faithful to the end. Does anybody have sort of a sixth sense that you've read something like that before? I hoped you did. This is how the King James Version says it. Alright, I'd like for you to look at those two and tell me how they differ. Well, first of all, let me take a vote. How many of you like the first one the best? How many like the second one the best? Good. I do too. Why do you like the second one the best?
Just put up your hands. We're going to talk about language here today.
Yes?
Is it figurative
language? Good figurative language. All right. We see sowing. We see mocking. They call up vivid word pictures in our minds, or pictures in our minds. We see reaping. Corruption, that's just really a good word. Weary, that's a good word. What else do you like about it?
That's a meter.
Okay, there's a cadence. Be not deceived, God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. He that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption, but he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. And let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not. In fact, I think probably Paul Erb would call that, I think he would probably call that poetry. I would call that poetry for the reasons we've just stated. All right, so... What we're interested in is how do we get from here to here? I guess I would say probably I seldom reach this level. Usually my writing is somewhere on that level. In fact, to be honest with you, that is my writing. And I tried to make it a little bit prosaic. It could have been done a little bit better than that, but I was trying to make it somewhat that way. All right. There's more than grammar here. There's more than grammar here. There's a feel. There's a feel for words. The value of words. The accent of words. The contrast of words. It's just a picture of having the right word at the right place at the right time. That's what we have. Now, the interesting thing is that in our day, we sort of have the impression if we would teach enough grammar, people would learn to write well. That's the impression I have, and I don't know what kind of English programs you have in your school, but that's the impression that I have from the textbooks that I see, that if we could just get them to diagram sentences right, if they just knew the parts of speech, if they just knew what a participle is, and certainly, if they knew what a gerund is, they'd be well on the way. Isn't that the impression you have? And you work hard, and these poor students scratch their heads. And the sad part about it is they get the whole way through all of that. And most of them, if you ask them 5 years later, would have a real problem telling you what it was they learned. And there are reasons for that. I had the good fortune the first year I taught school to teach in a school where they had made a mistake in purchasing the English textbooks, or so they thought. And so what I have to say today is colored pretty much by that first 3 years of teaching experience in a school where they had bought the wrong English text. Now, why did they say they had bought the wrong English text? Well, because they didn't have any grammar in them. They were the old D.C. Heath books, English is Our Language. Now, there was a little grammar in it. How many of you have ever seen that book? Well, they're long out of date, I'm sure. And the teachers in the elementary school where I taught just groused and groused and groused about these English books. And they bought Continental Press worksheets, and we had those old Spirit duplicators. You people don't have to contend with those old things. And we ran off sheets, and we gave students the grammar that was not in that book. And I did that the first year. The second year I decided, well, look, I'm gonna go with the program of this book. I'm gonna teach it the way they said. Well, what was in the book basically was selections of literature and writing assignments. And so the students were writing all of the time. That was basically what they were doing. And I made a very interesting discovery. At the end of the school year, they scored higher on the achievement tests in all aspects of English than they had the year before, when I had used all those Continental Press worksheets. That was interesting. And then I was surprised to learn that when the King James translators did this translating in 1611,
English did not even have a standard grammar. That's not how Shakespeare learned to write. And that's not how the King James translators learned to write, or anybody else who wrote in that era of the English language. English grammar, to my best ability to figure out what happened, was put together in the Boston grammar schools somewhere in the 1700s. And if you go back earlier than that, in fact, I don't know how many of you have been a little bit surprised. You hear that the King James Bible is such a wonderful specimen of English, but you find some funny constructions in it that don't even seem, some of them, like complete sentences. How many of you have been perplexed by that? That's how they wrote. And you'll find the same thing in Shakespeare, and you'll find the same thing in all the other writers who wrote at that time. But they knew the value of a word. That they knew. And the reason they did was because their training was not in structural grammar. It was in the classics. They had studied the classics, where words were used just the very best way they could possibly be used. And so they learned to get a feel for that classical usage of English. And that's what I would like to promote a little bit here today. I remember when I was a boy growing up, my father thought the best writer in the Mennonite church was J. Ward Schenck in Virginia, who wrote in fact, he was the editor of The Sword and Trumpet. And so as an older person, when I worked at Christian Life Publications, J. Ward Schenck would come in occasionally, and I said to him one day, Brother Ward, to what do you credit your very lucid, graphic, interesting style? And he said, I credit my style to my lifelong love for the usage, the words, and the phrasing of the King James Bible and Shakespeare. I thought that was interesting. Let me read you from some things from this era. First of all, let me read you another one from the King James. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Or this one from Shakespeare. Love moderately. Long love doth so. Too swift arrives as tardy as too slow. Now, you have to take a little time to figure that one out, but I just want you to get the feel for the words. Let me read it again. Love moderately. Long love doth so. Too swift arrives as tardy as too slow. What he's saying is if love is too superficial and fast, it won't get any there any faster and actually become true love than if somebody's too slow. I mean, too fast and too slow. You've got to do it at just the right speed. And if you've ever been in love, you know what he meant. Okay. Okay. Here's one of my favorites from Hamlet. To thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man. Isn't that beautifully phrased? And I want to tell you something. We talked about active constructions here. I was reading just recently about style, and this person said you won't find the word is in Shakespeare very frequently. I think he said not at all, but I won't stick my neck out quite that far. The constructions are sturdy, active, graphic constructions. In fact, besides the King James translators, I don't know of anybody but Shakespeare who could turn a phrase like he did. Let me read this one again. It happens to be my favorite. No, the next one is. This is my next to the favorite. To thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man. And then here's my favorite one. There is a tide in the affairs of men, which taken at the flood leads on to fortune. Omitted, all of life is bound in miseries and in shallows. On such a full sea we are now afloat, and we must take the current when it serves or lose our ventures. Isn't that beautifully stated? The picture of this person building a boat on the beach, making sure that it wasn't too far up, that the tide would not be close enough to shove it into the water. And then here comes the tide up to this boat. And you have to know just when to shove it. If you wait too long, the tide will start to recede and you'll never get the thing in the water. If you get it in the water, the whole world is yours. If you don't get it in the water, you just sit there on the sand. And the point that he's making in Julius Caesar is that they had come to just such a point. And this is how the character said, was telling his friends, it's time to move. We're at this point. And if we don't move, we're in trouble. Let me read it again. There is a tide in the affairs of men, which taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Omitted, all of life is bound in shallows and in miseries. On such a full sea are we now afloat, and we must take the current when it serves or lose our ventures. Now, grammar will not produce that kind of writing. It just won't. Let's just take the typical diagram sentence here. You'll have to overlook my snide remarks about this approach. I used to tell my colleagues who really believed in diagramming sentence that I believed in interdisciplinary studies. I believed in putting studies together. But I never could understand why you would put art together with English. Get a better pen. Okay. Here we have this wonderful sentence.
The large tree on the steep. This isn't a bad sentence. Hill was the tallest.
And now we're going to take a real venture into learning English. We're going to diagram this. I had to actually get one of my children's books to see how to do this. Because I'd forgotten. Tree and the and large and on hill the steep. Did I do it wrong? I was afraid to be somebody here that really knew how to do this well. Was tallest. Is that correct? Is that how it's supposed to be done? Now, I, for the life of me, don't know what we've accomplished by doing that. It just really escapes me. See, I look at that sentence, and I say, let's improve that sentence. But I think in terms of what we can do with the words of the sentence, not so much what we can learn about the structure of the sentence. No, is there something we can do better in that sentence? Now I'll open it up to you. What would you do if you were going to improve that sentence? The tallest tree was the large one on the hill. That's better. Yeah, you've managed to economize there a little bit. Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing I would do is I would decide what kind of tree it was. And when you choose a good noun, you basically minimize your use of adjectives. And adjectives are good in their place. We need adjectives. But if you can find one good noun that gets rid of the vague noun and tries to prop itself up with an adjective. See, this is a weak noun that's begging for something to give it a little bit more description. And so we say large tree. I don't like that nearly as well as saying the oak. I like the sound of oak. I like the brevity of oak. I like the word picture of oak. It just is better all around. Don't you think? How many agree? All right. The oak on the steep hill was the tallest. Well, we have another problem here. We'll see what we can do about that one. But I don't like this at all. I just don't like that was the tallest. Can anybody think of a verb? A good verb? By the way, the engine at the center of the every English sentence is the verb. The word verb means word. The verbs are the true words in the English language. And if you can get yourself a good verb and a good noun, you're going to have a good sentence or a good clause or whatever expression you were trying to write. But if you have weak nouns and weak verbs, you will be filling up your sentences with adjectives and adverbs to try to make these things a little bit more specific. In fact, there was an argument made after Woodrow Wilson was defeated in his bid for the League of Nations. A stylist, an English stylist, sat down and tried to analyze why he lost his bid for the League of Nations. And they took his speeches and they analyzed them. And they said they had too many adjectives in them. His sentences got too long and vapid and complex. And he lost his people in his speeches. So let's see if we can improve on this sentence a little bit. The oak. And let's come down here now and see if somebody can find us a good verb that says it was the tallest. Excellent. I'll write it. Okay. I mean, isn't that better? I mean, that just is an interesting word picture just right there. The oak, and you have a picture of a specific tree and all the sturdiness that oaks are known to have. And towered, I mean, now you see, it's not just taller than the other trees on the hill. It's much taller. It overwhelms the other trees. Okay? The oak towered over the other trees on the, and I'll let you help me again. Mountain? Oh, yeah. Yes, mountain would be good. Let's have a couple more suggestions. I like the feel of words. I like to choose the word. Are you familiar with the term onomatopoeia? How many are familiar with that term? It's in all of your grammar books, aren't I? Okay. See, there's a difference between saying cut your finger and sliced it.
And see, that's the difference between the person who can basically approach grammar structurally and get everything right and the person who gets the right word, not just for its meaning, but for its feeling and its emotional impact. In fact, the people who do that well are poets. That's what poetry is. That's precisely what divides poetry from prose. The good poet never makes a mistake in choosing just the right word and the right phrase. Not only to communicate the meaning, but to communicate the total experience, the feeling and the emotional impact and the cadence. You know, it makes its maximum impression on you. It appeals to your mind, it appeals to your feelings, it appeals to the rhythm of your body, it just appeals to everything if it's a good poem. And it's a total communication. Whereas that type of thing, it gets its point across. You know, people understand what you meant. But it does not pack the wallop that this does. All right, let's try a little bit harder. A word that has a little bit more of a
of what he said. Sharpness.
Cliff.
Okay. I would have used slope. Oop. I like the word slope. Slope. Just, I don't know, just, I like the way that word feels. Okay.
All right. I looked for a book that's out of print.
I wanted to bring it here and read it to you because it would have been funny while it was making its point. It's by Rudolf Flesch. How many have ever read any of his works?
Now, actually, if you want, and I did some of the examples I'm using today, I took out of this book. But if you want probably the most concise, interesting, and even funny approach to language and how to write, it's Rudolf Flesch's book, A New Guide to Better Writing, by Rudolf Flesch and A.H. Lass. But he wrote a book years ago that's out of print. I couldn't find it in any of the libraries. The title of it was How to Make Sense. And he had a whole chapter in there on grammar. And he said that the only reason he can think of for teaching young children grammar was so that they would know grammar. Now, don't misunderstand me. Older people need to understand what's happening in the English sentence. But I'm going to tell you in just a few moments why I think that should wait at least until junior high. I don't think that young children should be struggling to... In fact, I distinctly remember, maybe I was retarded linguistically, I don't know. Maybe I was a late bloomer. But do you believe that my teachers hammered grammar and I never learned what a prepositional phrase was till I was in college? I mean, after the teacher put it on the board, I could see it, but I could not see those things in those sentences. It drove me totally up a wall. In fact, I didn't understand much about grammar at all. I went to teach school in Ohio, and by that time I had learned quite a bit about grammar in some of my college studies and some of my own study. But I pulled out my old grammar test that the English 1 teacher gave right at the beginning of the course, where he had us underline the subject once and the simple verb twice. It was a total fiasco. I made an F on every grammar test he gave. And I managed to pass English, but I made an F on his grammar test. And so I'm going to make a comment here in a little bit what I think of teaching young children grammar. Now, it should be taught, but I think it can very well wait until junior high. And my experience is that when a child is old enough to begin to grasp what you're talking about, they'll learn the basic structure of the English language in very short order. It won't take all those years of beating small children's brains through grammar. The interesting thing is they come to school with a tremendous grasp of grammar already. They already know, basically, how an English sentence is supposed to be constructed. And Rudolf Flesch goes on to say, and like I said, I'm sorry I can't bring it and read it because it was really funny. He went on to say it would be like taking a young child at school who comes running in off the playground and saying, now we're going to have a course today on how to walk. And then we would get out protractors and all kinds of measuring instruments, and we would tell them how just exactly what angle you bend the knee when you walk, and how far forward you propel yourself before you bring the other foot forward. And we would go into this real detailed scientific explanation as to how you walk. And really, that makes a lot of sense. So, the reasons for not teaching grammar to elementary children. Now, I'm not talking to high school teachers.
Well, I am. That's right. We did that today. I'm talking basically now to elementary teachers. Don't go out of here and say that I said grammar is not important, because Rudolf Flesch devotes a whole section of this book to grammar. It is important, but it is not probably going to be very profitable to teach it to children through grade 6. Number one, before early adolescence, the logic of structural English is beyond the grasp of most students. And I learned that by hard experience. That is a true statement. What did you learn, brother? Did you find that to be true? Yes. Okay. I don't know what I'd have done if you'd disagree. All right. The logic of structural English is beyond the student's grasp before adolescence, by and large. I won't say every student, and I won't say that the average student won't get some of it, but by and large, it is not English to them, it's Greek. Number two, analysis will not help them to sense the power of words and phrases. I mean, you can diagram sentences till you're blue in the face, and it will not teach the child to appreciate God is, be not deceived, God is not mocked. It doesn't even begin to touch what that's all about. Number three, a structural approach gives the young child the impression that language is mechanical, difficult, and uninteresting. How many of you who have taught grammar, I mean diagramming to third graders and fourth graders, will confirm that statement? Well, maybe you won't agree with that. A structural approach gives the impression that language is mechanical, difficult, and uninteresting. And my fourth and last reason is that an emphasis on critiquing the writing of others does little to help the child to create with words. The emphasis is on critiquing the writings of others rather than learning to create with words. And you know that. Most of their time in English is spent copying the sentences that other people have written and diagramming them and analyzing them while they should be writing. That's what they should be doing. And what's that? That one again. You want them all? Okay. I should have written these out. Well, now I've shortchanged myself with my time. All right, the first one. Before early adolescence, the logic of structural English is beyond the student's grasp. Number two, analysis will not help them sense the power of words and phrases. Number three, a structural approach gives the impression that language is mechanical, difficult, and uninteresting. And number four, with grammar, the emphasis is on critiquing the writing of others rather than learning to create with words. So now you're probably saying, well, what are we going to do in English? Now, I don't want to get in trouble with any school boards. If they give you English books to teach and they expect you to go through them, you'll have to figure out what to do. You'll have to, I guess, do what you're expected to do, unless you can convince somebody otherwise. I'm not trying to create a rebellion here. But I definitely would do what I'm going to tell you along with that. I definitely would. The better option is to have the children keep journals. That's the better option. To have them writing every day. Now, when I taught school, which this was a little bit of a venture for me, I have not been in the classroom since 1985. And I haven't been in an elementary classroom since 1980, I think, or 70. No, 78. No, before that, 74. It's been a long time. But with all of my English teaching, once I realized, like I said, it was that mistake in the purchase of the English book that convinced me on this, I always had my students doing a lot of writing. I always had them doing a lot of writing. My high school students, which would have been my last teaching experience, turned in every week a 150 to 300 word theme. And there were some interesting outcomes with that, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Number one, here is the value of using journals. It teaches the value of words and skillful phrasing. Okay? It teaches them the value of words and skillful phrasing. And that's not all. Number two, it forces them to observe and listen. Because here's what happened. Now, I used literature, and I'm going to show you some things you can do with literature.
I use literature in my teaching of writing. But many times, I told the students, you can write on whatever you want to write on. And if you're worried about how you're going to come up with all these writing assignments, 80 to 90% of all the writing assignments, the writing that my students did, they chose their subject and they wrote on it. And I have a reason for that. The first thing that would happen is they'd come back to school in the fall and they'd write about their summer vacations. Number two, they'd write about why they didn't want to come back to school. That was the second thing. The third theme was on why they hated writing themes. And then they were all around my desk saying, President Martin, what am I going to write? I don't know what to write. And I said, well, writing originates from three sources. Personal observation, what you hear from other people, what you hear other people talking about. And number three, what you read. And when you tell me you have nothing to write about, you're telling me that you basically are not observing, and you're not listening, and you're not reading. By the time you're finished with 6 years in my English class, which was 7 through 12, you'll not be having that problem. And they didn't. They did. At the end of 6 years, they had learned that they had to listen and observe, because every week they had to have something to write about. And they came up with some marvelous subjects after about 2 or 3 years of forcing themselves to listen and to observe. And number three, the use of journals involves the student actively in the regular discipline of written expression. And all writers will tell you there's only one way to learn to write, and that is to write. That's it. All right. Let me pass out some
handouts here.
Why you should not always is because of what I just said.
There's times when you should.
Yes. Yes, you should actually do both. And if you're going to use literature, you're going to do that. You're going to say, here's what we looked at, now you go and imitate this. You go and do something similar to this. All right.
Does everybody get one of these?
Yeah, does everybody have one? That's fine. I'm just going to read down through this. Now, I know you read to your children, and they sort of subconsciously, if you read good literature to them, they sort of subconsciously begin to absorb a concept of style. But it's sometimes good to actually pass something like this out and take a look at it. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, so let's just look down through it. This is from A Penny's Worth of Character. How many know that story? Okay. Shan went through the gate toward the valley road, and he stopped once to look back when a peewee flew over his head with something in her bill. Now see, that could have been written that a little bird flew over his head carrying something. But you see how specific it is. The peewee flew over his head with something in her bill. She had made a nest of mud under the eaves. And there were young birds in that nest too. Shan had heard them crying for food. The student might have used the word begging. Then you can spend some time talking about the qualitative difference between the word begging and the word cry. The pathos is in the cry. And they need to learn, they have that called to their attention. They won't necessarily automatically realize the value of words unless you call it to their attention. Since he'd never been able to climb high enough to see, he'd often wondered how many young birds she had. He knew there were three young birds in the cardinal's nest. Shan loved the birds. He carried breadcrumbs, not just food. He carried breadcrumbs from the table and put them on top of the gateposts. Not just a post, but a gatepost. You see, a gate for the cardinals. But he didn't have time to watch them now, for he had to hurry, not just get, to Mr. Connolly's store to get the things for his mother and for himself. The morning was beautiful. Shan heard the songs of many wild birds hidden among the wild crabapple trees. Not just the wild birds in the trees. See, that's the way a lot of writing is done. He heard the birds in the trees. No. He heard wild birds hidden among the wild crabapple trees on either side of the valley. He knew that they were singing because they were as happy as he was. When he reached a big sycamore where people often sat to rest in the shade beside the road, he stopped again. There was a red-headed woodpecker holding on to a dead branch, not just a piece of wood, with his toes while he bored a hole, not just made a hole. He bored a hole with his long black bill. He made more noise than Shan's father made when he bored a hole into a plank, not just a board. Plank. Is there a difference with you between board and plank? I like the crisp finality of plank. With a brace and bit. That's better than just a drill. With a brace and bit. When the woodpecker saw Shan looking up at him, he stopped to look down at Shan. But he didn't stop very long. He went back to boring into the tree again. Then Shan remembered his father telling him that the woodpeckers bored into dead trees to find worms. Shan's father had once shown him when he was cutting stove wood, not just wood, with an axe. He could have said he showed him one time when he was cutting wood. No, he was cutting stove wood with an axe. The kind of worms the woodpeckers bored into trees to get. There were little white worms with brown heads. The worms could eat their way into the trees. Not just find their way or get into the trees. They eat their ways into the trees. Shan thought it was strange that animals and birds liked to eat. He knew the woodpecker probably liked such things better than not just candy, chocolate bars, and lemon soda pop. Now, you go down through that, of course, you spend a lot more time. Because students often say, what do you write? And what happens is they just write the bare bones of the description. They don't go into all the details and describe it and graphically picture it so you can see it. And so, after a little discussion on something like this, you tell them, now your assignment is go take a walk. And then tomorrow in class, if you want to take a notebook along, that'll be fine. I would suggest that all of the writing of the journals in elementary be in class. Tomorrow in class, you will write a description of what you saw. Take a notebook along, write down details, colors, shapes, names of the things that you saw on the little walk that you took. And then see if you can write with some of those really picturesque details tomorrow in class. Now, why do I say they should write in class? Well, some of you are saying, I teach first grade or I teach second grade. How in the world are these children going to write? They don't know how to spell. Well, I never taught first and second grade, but I talked to a teacher who had first and second graders write journals, and she said that the way she handled that was she told the child to go ahead and write. Just write. And when they came to a place where they didn't know the word, they were just to put a line. And then she would be coming around the class and they could ask her how to spell the word. And then they would write the word in the line and then they would also keep it in the list at the bottom of the page and they would learn to spell it. She said the interesting thing about that is that they kept their journals in a spiral notebook. And she said after you got through partway through the year, that little journal became a dictionary. Oh! That word. Oh, I wrote it. Yeah, that word's back there. And they would go back and look up these words. And that is really a little bit more delightful way to learn to spell than what we usually use, isn't it?
Right.
Yes.
More time you spend behind the mic, the better off we are.
I'm sorry.
No problem.
Very well. I'll stay put then. All right. Next page. I want the one that says now the maples were left behind. I think I had them out of order. And while they're doing these journals, you should walk around through the class and you should talk about these kinds of things with them. What kind of tree was it? Can you tell me exactly what kind of tree it was? Can you think of a word that says it was the tallest? You know, you should ask those kinds of questions and help them start to evaluate a choice of a better word. Okay? And now here we have, as far as I'm concerned, we have writing for small children at its best. I don't know how many of you teach the book Singing Wheels. How many, are those books still around? How many read them when you were young? Okay. Now the maples were left behind and the road stretched straight ahead through the treeless prairies. Now remember I told you that the verb is the word that makes the English language do its work. Farmlands rolled easily away to the horizon, and golden fields of headed grain were interspersed with the green of waving corn. Overhead was the great gray-blue heat-laden sky of midsummer. The sun shone hot on the fields, hot on the widening stretches of road that came forward to meet them. Dust rolled up in clouds behind them, cut into their faces with the hot wind of the moving car, and settled thick and gray on the cherry red paint and on the seat beside them. A few more miles and the road grew ruddy with wagon tracks. Again they jounced and bounced along. A workhorse grazing at ease in a field near the roadside snorted and dashed to safety at the other end of the field. Now and then they passed a farm wagon or two or an occasional farmer in his buggy. Horses balked and shied. Now you want to talk about onomatopoeia, that has it. Shivered their fright as the car bumped past. Once an angry farmer cut at them with his buggy whip. My assignment, if I were using this piece of literature, is say, tomorrow I want you to observe everything you see on your way coming to school. Again, take out your notepad and write down some notes on exactly what you saw. And tomorrow we're going to try to write and we're going to try to describe what we saw with these kinds of action words. And that would be it. Okay, here's another one. This one is from Rudolf Flesch's book. Now, if you ask most children to describe the house that they live in, they would probably say, we live in a two-story house with six rooms. That would be the end of the statement, okay? And so what you have to help them. Because young writers and inexperienced writers don't know that when you write a description, you describe in detail so that when you're finished, the person can see what's in all of those six rooms. All right? We live in a house on Chestnut Street, which is about 10 minutes from Main Street. The house is a typical colonial house, white with green shutters. It sits a little back from the road, and there's a nice front yard with two big old trees. Inside, it looks like this. When you come in the front door, and this is not difficult for them to do. You tell them that you're going to describe your house, and you're going to be standing right outside the front door. And I want to know exactly what you see before you walk in the front door, what you see when you walk in, and then I want you to methodically go through the house and describe the inside of your house, just in the sequence of your observation. Inside, it looks like this. When you come in the front door, you're in a little hall where there's not much else but a hall closet and the stairs going up right in front of you. There are two glass doors right and left, and you get glimpses of the living room to your right and the study to your left. Suppose you go into the living room. It's shaped like an L that's hugging the front porch. The door to the front porch is right across the door from the hall. And then you go on, just going through the house and describing each room. That's another possibility. All right, turn to the next one. Because most students say, well, they write this two sentences about their house, and they say, well, I didn't know what else to write. So you have to help them visualize how you would describe and flesh out the description. This is also from Singing Wheels. Sally had big brown freckles in the end of her nose and blue eyes that twinkled and twinkled. She had two long braids of yellow hair that never stayed smooth the way they were supposed to stay. No one could say that Sally's hair was curly. No one could ever say that. But it was wavy enough to pull out the braids and to make little rings around her face and to look as if it had never been combed. Now you call to the student's attention that all of that was simply describing her hair. I mean, it didn't just say she had brown hair. It gave you the texture of her hair, the way it lay on her head, what people thought of it, what people didn't think of it, the color of it, how it matched her eyes. All right. Oh, and we already had her nose and her eyes. And so when they describe somebody, what they're going to see when they read this is, well, describe their nose, describe their eyes, describe their hair, describe their ears, describe their mouth, describe their clothes, describe their shoes. Just give a thorough description. Color, texture, shape. And then they can use this as an example. Sally had a mouth that turned up at the corners. Maybe that is what made her a tease. When your mouth turns up at the corners, you can't always help what it makes you do. Not always. If you had looked at the rest of Sally, not at her face and her two yellow braids, you never would have guessed that she could have started a quarrel. You certainly wouldn't. All of the rest of Sally was just a plain dark dress of sheep's gray wool. The dress had a short, tight waist and a long skirt that reached down to her shoe tops. A black sheep and a white sheep had furnished the wool that went into its making, and that is why it wasn't black and it wasn't white, but just a sheep's gray. Pepper and salt is what you might have called it. No one could see anything pretty in that dress. No one could possibly stretch his imagination that far. But then, it wasn't supposed to be pretty. That is good writing. And you would be amazed at how hard many of your students will try to write that kind of description if they're given those kinds of examples and you discuss them. All right, just some things as you're walking around the class that you want to do. These are points that you want to emphasize. The most important thing for you to develop as far as a structural understanding of grammar is what we call sentence sense. Sentence sense. And I have found it was better taught by constantly calling students' attention to the phrasings that they wrote than it was to have a structural grammar lesson on what a sentence is. Now, you're going to talk about what a sentence is, to be sure. But help them to correct their run-on sentences. You know what a run-on sentence is. I was going to write these, but I'll just read them. A run-on sentence reads like this. The boy came home, he really wanted to stay, and that's all run together with no punctuation. And tell them that when, you know, here we have two statements. The boy came home. And when you say it, you want to stop there. We'll put a period. Because that's a sentence. He really wanted to stay. You know, that stands by itself. Those are two statements. Just punctuate them. And for young children, that'll just be periods. And they'll make two sentences. When they get a little older, obviously, they can put a comma and a coordinating conjunction. Like but, and, or so, or something like that. And if they're older still, they might want to use semicolons. Just simply to put those two together and leave them separate in their statement. All right? Correct comma splices. I mean, students should not be writing with sentences run together. And actually, if you can get that accomplished by the end of grade 4, it won't matter if they don't know what an adjective is. Now, honestly, it won't. I see students that have been through structural grammar upon structural grammar upon structural grammar, and they still don't have any sentence sense, which is far more important than knowing the fine points of the parts of speech and modifiers and phrases and clauses and participials and gerunds and infinitives and ad nauseum, okay? So comma splices, I take them seriously. I mean, my students knew that I hated them. I hated run-on sentences. I hated comma splices. All right? Another thing I hated was I hated introductory elements that were not separated from the main part of the sentence with a comma, like this. All right, that comma needs to be there. It needs to be there. And you just keep hammering away. And believe me, after 6 years of it, they learned it. I mean, or even after 1 or 2 years of it, they learned it. I'm amazed. If you want me to tell you what amazed me when I got into commercial copy editing, it was the horrible mistakes of this sort that the professionals make. I did a whole textbook on education written by the education department of Kent State University about a year ago. And it was full of run-on sentences, comma splices, missing essentials of all sorts, and besides sentences that were plain down incomprehensible. All right? Edit out unnecessary words. Teach them economy in their writing. Now, the examples I'm going to use, I pulled from the medical stuff that I do. And these I'm constantly changing. Due to the fact that he came late. What's wrong with saying because he came late? Get rid of this due to the fact, get rid of the due to the fact stuff. There's nothing wrong with the lowly because. Here's another one. I spied the man prior to the service. What should it be? I spied the man before the service. See, I went to college and I got the impression that you were supposed to write this kind of gobbledygook. And when I got finished with college and writing all my papers that impressed my professors with my great erudite approach to English because of the way I could jumble up sentences with difficult words and phrases, I had to read Rudolf Flesch and learn to write just good, straightforward prose, and I had to learn that words like before actually were acceptable. You didn't have to say prior to. Listen to this one. He did the job in a manner similar to the way he did it before. Now, I added this stuff, I took this right out of a medical manuscript. How would you say it? He did the job in a manner similar to the way he did it before. Okay, I don't like he did it before. That has the whole problem of, there's a problem there. Just use as. The word like, by the way, should be used simply for comparison. If you want a rule for like. He looks like his sister. Okay. He did the job I don't have it right yet. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't cross out manner. He did the job as he did it before. Just get rid of manner similar to the way. And you'll find many ways to economize on words. Listen to this one. The girl who was beside me fainted. The girl beside me fainted. What's this who was stuff about? Of course, we'd have diagrammed that, and we'd have said that is a dependent clause. That's what we'd have done with that one.
And we'd have gone into this great big thing about dependent clauses, and we'd have taught them to write who was beside me so they would learn dependent clauses. Get rid of it. There's no need for a dependent clause here. Okay? Prefer the simple, familiar word. Now, the English language is a unique language. It is a compilation of a bunch of other words from other languages. And here's what happened to the English language. In 1166 A.D., do I have that date right, brother? 1166 A.D., William the Conqueror, who was a French leader, conquered England and forced the French language on the English people. Before that, it was Anglo-Saxon, which was a Germanic language. And so for I forget how many centuries, the English-speaking people were forced to do all of their official business in French. And so these French words found their way into the English language. Rationalization, utilize, and all of this. Now, they have their place. But the thing about it is, the old Anglo-Saxon was never lost. The people out there in the hamlets never learned the French. And so instead of saying veranda, they kept saying porch, a good old Anglo-Saxon word with a little bit of flavor to it. Instead of saying a monolithic structure, they said a stone structure. And so we had these good old Anglo-Saxon words. And so that's why you hear people say, just speak in Anglo-Saxon. It'll be words like porch and words like stone, words like, anyway, I have a listing somewhere that I forgot to bring. Okay. So here are some. We need to utilize all of our resources. Just cross out utilize and put use. In fact, if I let those pass, in fact, I never use the word utilize. I literally do not utilize it. I get rid of it. I mean, it doesn't say anything with its extra syllables. We need to use all of our resources. I want to get you over the hang-up of using good, simple language. These words are good words. Please see me following dismissal. There's a French word. After is the Anglo-Saxon, or the simple word. In order to get the job done, hurry. To get the job done, don't use in order to. Just drop it. The majority of the people left. Most. And now I've gotten you started. Just don't be afraid to just start doing that. I do it all the time. Like I said, I took these right out of the manuscripts that I edit. And I cross these words out, several of them on every page. I mean, people are just verbose with this stuff. Okay? Number three, or four, I guess it is. Help the students to be precise with their word order. What's wrong with this sentence? I only needed three nails. Now, I see this all the time. I see it in the Reader's Digest, in fact. I needed only three nails. I only needed. I don't know what that means. I only needed. I know what needed only means, but I'm not sure what only needed means. Maybe you can come and tell me after class. Number four. Or number five, I guess we are by now. You say, well, what are we going to do with usage? That's a good question. There's no point in going through page after page after page of usage they already know. But while you're going around, pick out the usages that they have wrong and spend time on those and maybe make up some worksheets and drill them on the ones they don't know. Have went. The car needs washed. If you want me to have my temperature to rise a couple degrees, say that one. The car needs washing. Now, you won't be able to explain to a child why it's washing instead of washed. That happens to be a gerund instead of a verb. But anyway, Pick them out. One of the boys is going. Not one of the boys are going. Now, these are in your grammar books, but you're going to teach them by memory, not by structural analysis. Just simply say, this is the way you say this. This is wrong to say it this way. And you can explain why. You can say, in this sentence, we're saying, one is going. You don't have to go into all the explanation of grammar. You can just say, can't you see that the boys aren't all going? So then it's not boys are, it's one is. And you don't need to go into any more explanation than that. All right? And you can teach lie and lay and all of those things by memory. All right? Clarify transitions. Now, children won't use many of these. So you don't need to do more than just teach them some connecting words. Now, when they get older, then there's some more sophisticated ways. Sometimes you have to write a transitional sentence to get from this sentence to this sentence. Sometimes you have to write a whole transitional paragraph to get from this paragraph to this paragraph. But for children, if you look back at the stuff that I gave you, they're about the only transitional stuff you have there are words like this. Meanwhile, he walked to town. Meanwhile, his brother slept. If you say he walked to town, his brother slept, you need some connection words in there. And so there's a whole bunch of them that you can talk about with the children. First, next, finally, meanwhile, later, afterward, since then, nearby, besides, but, still, however, therefore, and so on. Particularly watch out for the participial phrase that is wrongly placed or wrongly used at the beginning of a sentence. Here's what I'm talking about. I'm picking out the ones that I remember were pet peeves of mine that I constantly had to work on. Here's one. Brightly shining, I strolled out to see the stars. Before going to school, our dog needs his walk. When you have a participial at the beginning like that, it has to modify the word that comes exactly next. And here's a real pet peeve of mine. Correct faulty parallelism. Now, we had this, be not deceived, God is not mocked. No, I'm not sure if there was any parallelism in that one. There wasn't one of them we talked about. Here's what I'm talking about. Listen to this. What's wrong with this? The activities included bikes, playing with toys in the sand, reading, and swings. They should all be ing, or they all should be nouns. I mean, you make up your mind. This is the one that if you are a copy editor, you can ask my wife. Some of my hair would be brown if I didn't have these. But you can sit sometimes and literally bite the point off your pencil to figure out how you're ever going to correct the huge gobbledygook of stuff they threw together with commas. But that's not parallel. All right? Help the students develop sentence variety. And I'll tell you what three things that involves. It involves questions and answers. It involves short sentences alternated with longer sentences. And it involves no sentences exactly alike in their construction. That's basically the three things we're talking about. We're talking about sentence variety. And now you have a... No, I have it on a... Here we go. Let's see if I can find it. How do you like this? All right, let's work on this one a little bit. And, you can pass something out like this, and you can say, what's wrong with this? Well, it's boring. In fact, not only is every sentence begun with there was, but every sentence is the same length. There was a lively debate among the students. There was great enthusiasm for the idea. There was hardly a dissenting voice. There was full agreement on the project in the end. Now, maybe you might want to take this down. I'm going to show you what can be done with this. The debate was lively. And now that's a statement. Ask rhetorical questions. That just makes it interesting. Why don't you say this next? Question. You know, I told you, questions and answers. An excellent way to vary writing. And then you answer. See, the sentence at the end is longer than any of them. Okay.
It's down too far. Yeah.
Okay. In fact, I'll tell you what we're going to do. See if I had any more here to... Oh, I wanted to give you the English language in brief, so that if any of you had any trouble figuring out how it was put together. I had a friend of mine who took English in college, and he didn't, he almost was going to flunk the course. And I said, you come up to my house, and I'll show you how English is put together on 1 8.5 by 11 sheet. Do you want me to give you that? All right, I'll do that. And then what I would like for you to do, I wish we had time. If Brother Melvin gets finished on time, and you have time during break, you write it. Do you see at the top? I had some exercises in the bottom there of changing passive constructions into active ones. Let me just do those for you. We left at dawn and the hotel was reached early in the afternoon. Obviously, it should have been this way. We left at dawn and reached the hotel early in the afternoon. As he was strolling through the woods, a cry for help was suddenly heard from the direction of the lake. It should be, as he was strolling through the woods, he heard a cry. Suddenly heard a cry from the direction of the lake. First read the entire paragraph, then any errors that are found should be corrected. It should be, first read the entire paragraph and correct any errors that are found. The book was read from cover to cover before I went to bed. I read the book from cover to cover before I went to bed. And you should always be striving. In fact, the publishers will tell you, if you're an editor, every time you possibly can, change a passive construction to an active one, because it immediately sparks more interest and creates a word picture. But what I'd like for you to try to do, and if I have time, I'll put my version of this on the overhead. Number one, see how much sentence variety you can get into this paragraph. I am sorry for the long delay. I have not written for 4 weeks, but I have some excuse for my behavior. I've been working at the store all these weekends and evenings. Maybe you can see what you can do with that one. Let me just quickly give you a picture of structural grammar that you really should have so that you can understand what's happening. Now, there's a lot more to English than what I'm going to put on here, but this is the bare bones. I told you that English basically is predicated, and that's an interesting way of saying it, is predicated on the verb. The verb is the word to look at. Okay, so there are basically three kinds of verbs. And once you understand that, you're well on the way to understanding the English language. Here's the first kind. The farmer planted a tree. All right? This is an active verb that has an object. That's the one kind of verb. Okay? And now this is basically the same sentence, but it has just one little thing added to it. It's still the same kind of verb, but I'm putting it on here for a reason you'll see later. The farmer planted me a tree. I should put John in there for the purpose I'm going to use. Okay? That's the one kind of verb. An active verb with an object. Okay? The second kind of verb is an active verb without an object. Those of you who have studied it know that this is what we call a transitive verb, and this is what we call an intransitive verb. Those are the two active types of verbs. Okay? The one requires an object. You can't just say the farmer planted. And you can't say the farmer sighed. Yes, you can. The farmer sighed a big sigh. It could have an object, right? All right? The next kind of verb is a linking verb. This verb right here. It's a linking verb. The reason it's called a linking verb is it simply links the first part of the sentence with something at the end of the sentence that actually belongs to the subject. And in this case, it's an adjective. We call it a predicate adjective. And this is still a linking verb. It's going to be doing something different. Okay. And this is linking, but it's linking a noun to the subject. This is not part of the verb. This belongs to the subject. That's why it's called a linking verb, and this is a predicate noun. Now, actually, every other sentence and every other clause in the English language is a variation of those five patterns. That's all there are. I mean, you can add adjectives, and you can add verbs, and you can add adverb phrases, and you can add adverb clauses, and you can do all kinds of things with that basic form. But all other clauses and sentences in the English language are a variation of that form. All right? That's the verb. There's something you have to understand about nouns. And the only reason I'm not going any further than this today is because I'm talking to elementary teachers. Now, obviously, as students get older, there are many other things to talk about. But upper elementary, this is about all they probably will ever be able to really get a hold of. There are five ways that you can use a noun, and only five ways that you can use a noun. This is how I learned grammar, to track it into a corner and say, these are the only possibilities. And so when I see a noun in a sentence, then it's going to have to be used one of five ways. Here's the one. The cat treed a mouse. It can be used as a subject. The dog treed a cat. It can be used as a direct object. He grabbed the tail of the cat. It can be used as the object of a preposition. He made the cat some food. It can be an indirect object. The patient was a cat. It can be a predicate noun. And those are the only usages of a noun. It's a direct object. It's an indirect object. It's the object of a preposition. It's a predicate adjective, or it's a subject of the sentence. And that's also true for noun clauses. It'll be one of those five. And when I finally got this through my head, the basic function of verbs and nouns, then everything else is simply modifiers. And they can get very complicated, but it simplified it a great deal for me to see that these were the patterns we were talking about, and there were no exceptions. That is just the way the English language works. Okay, I've overrun my time. Does anybody have any questions? it would have been fun to play with some of the stuff that we had here, the one that I just gave you, and I had some others here, to just see what we could do with them, to revise them according to some of the things we talked about, but we'll have to skip that. Does anybody have any questions? I hope you all go back, and even though you have to teach structural grammar, which I strongly discourage, I hope you all institute the writing of journals, at least alongside that, and have them write every day. And most of the students, after about a year of that, will actually learn to enjoy it. They really will. Shall we bow our heads for a word of prayer? Our Father, we thank you today that you made it possible for us to communicate with words. Lord, you made it possible for us to think. We think with words. Lord, help us to be precise with our words so that we can be precise with our thoughts and precise in communicating the important issues of life to other people without misunderstanding. Communicate in a way that it makes an impact on their consciousness. Help us to teach our children to appreciate the value of words and the value of written expression and the beauty and the enjoyment of having the right words and the right phrases written in the right way. Bless us to that end. I pray that every teacher here would be able to instill that in each of his or her students. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.